Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, our incomes, our jobs, our debts, our futures, those of our children, all of that kind of thing that besieges us literally every day. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. Let me expand for a moment, since a number of you have asked me where I went to school and where I taught before. I got my education in the elite schools of the United States. I was an undergraduate at Harvard, then I went to Stanford in California, and my PhD in economics is from Yale University. I taught at Yale, I taught at the City University of New York, I taught at the University of Paris called the Sorbonne, and for most of my adult life, I was a professor at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Let me invite you also to consider looking at our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. If this program interests you, if this kind of analysis is something you're interested in, you will find there at those websites a great deal more of this kind of material, and I urge you to make use of it. We update it every day, and I'll have more to say about that later on. I also want to thank you particularly because we tried over the last 3 weeks to a different format for this program, and we asked you to comment to us what you thought about it. Many, many of you did so. Thank you very much for this kind affirmation that what we do here matters to you. We had a kind of a split in the response, a few more interested in doing more of the kind of work we did in the last 3 weeks. So we're going to expand that part of it, but also hold on to the older format of mixing shorter economic updates at the beginning, doing some response to your comments and questions, and then delving more deeply into particular topics. So much for that. Let's jump right in. I want to begin today with a brief discussion of an announcement coming from the soda wars, we call them, the endless war between Coca-Cola and PepsiCo to try to control and manipulate the soft drink business in the United States and indeed around the world, and their latest, maneuvers. I'm trying to be polite. So Coca-Cola just announced, very happy, that their profits increased by 19% over the last year, even though the sales of what they make, basically drinks and other things like that, declined by 3%. In other words, their total sales didn't do well, actually shrank, but that's okay because they made a lot more money off of a shrinking number of drinks. So being an economist, I looked into that, and I thought you'd be interested in what I found. Coca-Cola has responded to the fact that more and more of the people it sells those drinks to have more and more difficulties making ends meet. So what they did is they produced fancy new bottles, fancy new containers, but more importantly, smaller ones, ones containing fewer ounces. And then they did what they're so proud of this week. They jacked up the price per ounce of what you actually get in the smaller container. That's why they sold less drinks, fewer drinks in the last year, but made more money off them. Why? Because you, dear drinker public, are being required to pay more per ounce of what you get than you used to. Now, if you think at a time when people are having a difficulty, this is a mean kind of trick to play, you're right. If you think it's an example of how capitalism works, that no matter what the conditions are, the name of the game is to increase profit, well, you're right again. That is the system we live in. Why would we be surprised if Coca-Cola takes advantage of it? But here's another dimension of the soda wars that also reveals how our system works. PepsiCo, the lead rival to Coca-Cola, always struggles to increase its market share compared to Coca-Cola's. And a recent move by PepsiCo, having to do with its Diet Pepsi brand, is that it announced it is no longer going to use aspartame. Aspartame is a chemically produced artificial sweetener. It's what makes the drink have no calories compared with regular Pepsi that uses cane sugar and so forth. PepsiCo, having responded to and made a loud noise about how responsive it is, it has responded to concerns by medical professionals and customers about health problems, including cancer, that might be associated with aspartame, has now promised it will not use it anymore. Coca-Cola wants to do nothing of the sort. They are going to continue to use aspartame. Coca-Cola insists that science will sooner or later vindicate them. PepsiCo, not so sure. For the customer, what is it we're faced with? Two corporate giants using in their struggle the fears we all have that we may be ingesting dangerous chemicals. They manipulate that fear in their struggles with one another. That's how a capitalist competitive system works. We're left to figure out what the risks are and who is ripping us off with which claim, which way. Carrying this same theme forward, let me turn to a remarkable event this last week when 100 prominent oncologists, that is doctors specializing in cancer and cancer treatment, associated particularly with the Mayo Clinic, one of the foremost cancer research and treatment facilities in the world, issued a statement that appeared in the Mayo Clinic proceedings, in which these 100 prominent oncologists announced their support for a grassroots movement to stem the rising cost of cancer drugs. In an article on this statement by the 100 prominent oncologists that appeared in the New York Times of July 23, lead article in the business section on that day in the New York Times, it was said that cancer drugs now, and I quote, routinely exceed $100,000 a year. And further, the article in the Times says, newer cancer drugs routinely exceed $150,000 a year. That, of course, has to be paid by the insurance companies, at least for most of these sufferers from cancer, and that in turn allows and provokes the insurance companies to jack up everybody's premium rates. And what is it the oncologists say? They say it isn't justified. They say it's outrageous. They say these high prices are not necessary. And so they go on record supporting grassroots movements around the United States to demand change. And they ask for two particular things whose economics I want to take a moment to explain. First, they want patients in the United States to be allowed to regularly buy drugs in Canada and from Canada. So much for the claim that drug companies have put forward that somehow it isn't safe to use the same drug if you buy it from Canada compared to the United States. And why, indeed, are drugs in Canada, as in most other countries, so much cheaper than they cost here? The basic answer is that in most other countries, they have a national health service, as indeed Canada does. And in most of these countries, the National Health Service negotiates with the drug companies to buy drugs in huge quantities. Like anything else, if you buy huge quantities, you get a lower price. So all that happens is the government negotiates with the monster drug companies, gets a lower price, and then passes that lower price on to the customer, the average person. But we're not talking about a cold or the flu. We're talking about cancer, a system or a disease that kills large numbers of people. So when drug companies jack up the prices, when they maneuver in Congress, as they did, to prevent Medicare from negotiating with them the way similar institutions negotiate with drug companies in other countries, it means you are really ripping off the most vulnerable people in our society. People fighting cancer, desperate to survive, and willing to pay or pressing their insurance companies to pay these wild prices for drugs, which are not the prices charged in other countries. It is an example of profit-driven medical care that takes advantage of the most vulnerable and literally becomes a death-dealing decision if there are people, as I'm sure there are, who go without these drugs because they haven't got the insurance and they can't cover them. I was even more, let's be honest, disgusted when I found out that President Clinton, former President Clinton, spoke last month, June 2015, in Philadelphia to pharmaceutical executives, warning them that there was rising popular anger about the outrageous prices and profits of huge pharmaceutical companies, and urging them to get their side of the story out, I kid you not, because otherwise they'd be in trouble. Not nice to see, not nice to hear, and something to think about. Okay, next short update. I want to congratulate Jeremy Corbyn. He is a fighter for the position of leader of the Labour Party in the United Kingdom. The Labour Party has had a sad history in recent decades, particularly since and including Tony Blair as their leader, a history of basically participating rather than being the opposition to the austerity programs imposed on the British working class in order to pay for the costs of a declining capitalism that plunged the country, as it did the world, into the crisis since 2008, that the costs of bailing out the British banks and big corporations has now been shifted onto the British people in the form of rising taxes and reduced public services. Jeremy Corbyn is a loud, strong opponent to this, and those of us who care about these things are very hopeful that he may regain, for the people who are really an opposition force, the leadership of the Labour Party. It is, in a way, for Britain, what the Bernie Sanders effort represents in the United States. And it deserves more attention and more discussion than either the British media or the American media are giving to this important effort. Finally, short update. My hat is off to another remarkable individual. This case, Pope Francis, the new Pope for the Roman Catholic community. I mean, he has been making statements about economics, which is why we bring him onto this program, in terms of what he's been saying, and in particular in recent weeks, as he has made a trip to Latin America, and as he is in a couple of months going to be addressing a joint session of the United States Congress, it is important to ask, what are his views on economics? And they are remarkable. He has basically attacked the existing economic system in the world. He seems to shy away from using its name, capitalism. He talks about the global economic system. He talks about the oppressive conditions of today's economic system, words like that, phrases like that. But what he means is unambiguously clear. And here's what he says. The current economic system is fundamentally unfair, fundamentally bad for the vast majority of people around the world. But he goes beyond that. He goes beyond the tradition of social teaching in the Roman Catholic Church, a tradition that often spoke about the dignity of labor and the dignity of working people. He goes beyond that, echoing it, but going beyond it by saying that a modern economy has an obligation, his words, to provide every citizen with a decent home, a decent life, and a job, and that it is a commandment of the Christian faith that that obligation be realized, and that if you do not do that, If you do not support an economic system that provides everyone, everyone, with a decent job and income and a place to live, then you are going against the teachings of Jesus Christ. He made that crystal clear in Bolivia, and he has done so repeatedly. I would urge those of you that are interested to take a look at the work of the journalist Christopher Hale, H-A-L-E, that appears in Time magazine and a number of other places. Mr. Hale elaborates, traveling, I believe, with the Pope, he elaborates on what is going on and the enormous, and this is his word, revolutionary implications of the Pope saying that he personally is with the people at the bottom of society, the middle and lower classes, the majority, in the need for them, and I quote again, to rise up and change an immoral economic system. Wow. This is a Pope who minces few words, who seems to recognize, if one reads a little bit between the lines, that this is a system that is polarizing the world into a tiny number of very rich people and a vast number of people whose economic circumstances are being pinched with no end in sight, and that this is inappropriate, unchristian, and immoral, and that he wants to align his church and his papacy with a movement from below to change this. This bears watching, as does the question, will he say such things to the joint session of Congress in a couple of months, or will he shrink from doing so? We will be watching, and I shall comment either way, depending on what he says when he does that. Let me turn now, as we usually do at this point in our program, to responding to some of your questions that you have sent in recent weeks. The first one has to do with asking my comments on the notion of a guaranteed basic income. This question comes to us from time to time, so this is as good a chance as any to respond. There are a variety of ideas. They've been around for quite some years, that there is more than enough wealth in the world today that would enable countries, many countries, and eventually the whole world, to guarantee to every human being a basic minimum annual income so that nobody is left behind, not just no child left behind, but how about no child and no adult either left behind, that we have the wealth to provide everyone with a minimal standard of living, residence, eating, and so on. It came very close to becoming law in Switzerland last year when it was put up for referendum. Other parts of the world are having various kinds of discussions and debates. Given the relative backwardness about economic issues that characterizes official discussions in the United States, you don't see and hear about it all that much. But even here, it percolates just below the surface. Well, I'm not in favor of it, and let me explain why. My fear is that if we moved in the direction of a guaranteed minimum basic income, while it would certainly help people who need it, and that part of it, of course, I support, it creates, or at least there's the risk of it creating, a basic split in our society, which I think would be extremely dangerous and extremely unhealthy politically and culturally for our society. And that is the split between those who live at whatever that minimum is versus those who don't live at that level, who work in a job someplace and earn more money than that. I don't believe that's a basis for democracy. I think that's a basis for a two-class system, and that the two classes would have a great deal dividing them and a great deal of social tension emerging from their interactions. So here's what I would prefer. Why not do the rational thing? Should have done it all along. The only reason we don't do it is because it is not something that capitalism tends to want. Let's take the number of jobs that we need to provide the standard of living we wish to live at. And then let's have everybody have such a job. If making everybody participate as a shared work obligation, the kind of obligation we think is appropriate for all members of a community that shares the work as well as the benefits. And if that means that the jobs for everybody who is able to work produces more than we need, then let everybody enjoy leisure. Let everybody work maybe a 6-hour day, maybe a 5.5-hour day, maybe a 30-hour week. It doesn't really matter. The rational thing would be to say, what is the amount of work it takes to produce a reasonable standard of living for everybody? And if we want to make some higher and others lower, fine, as long as that's worked out democratically. And then let's assign the work equally to everybody. Not some people who work and earn and others who don't. That's a recipe for social conflict, social division, and ultimately social disaster. What I'm proposing is more leisure if we don't need the output, if we want to preserve our planet, if we care about the environment, if we want to use fewer resources, good. Let all the work be assigned to people in fewer hours a day per week. That way we conserve resources, we enhance leisure, and we have a unified community, everybody having a job, participating in one way or another in a shared enterprise. Not some people working and other people living off the work of the first. We're going to come back to that sad theme later. And that's my response to this proposal. Finally, a question that several of you have sent in, and again, this has come repeatedly, so this is my chance to respond. The particular question that really got to me was came from a resident in Florida who informed me that the governor there and or other high officials have been making a big to-do about how Florida is better off by having fewer public employees. And the comparison was even made by one chief executive there that Florida is better off than Greece because Florida has a smaller percentage of its workers working for the government. Now, this is an endlessly repeated idea of the right wing and the conservatives in this country, and even others who should know better. And the idea goes something like this. Workers in the private sector work hard. They are productive. They really give their all. Whereas workers in the public sector aren't. And therefore, the more people you have working in the public sector, the less successful your economy will be, the less productive your economy will be. The idea is to attack and undermine public employees, get the government to fire them, get the government to reduce their pensions, get the government to cut public services. That's what this is really about. But the way you get at it is by attacking the value, the usefulness, the social benefits from public employment. Okay, so now let's ask the question. Let's actually do the work rather than repeat these right-wing ideas. Let's ask the question, how do different countries compare in terms of the percentage of their people that are public employees on the one hand, and how well they're doing on the other? Are these countries wealthy or poor? Are they growing quickly or slowly? Is the standard of living higher or lower? In other words, are conservatives right to see that high public employment is some negative sign economically? Well, I could give you my answer, but I have a better option. I'm going to give you the answer of a very conservative economist who actually looked into it. He's actually an economist, but also a judge. His name is Richard Posner, P-O-S-N-E-R. He's a federal judge sitting in Chicago, and he's also a lecturer in the economics department of the University of Chicago, one of the most conservative economics departments in the world. And he often worked together until a few years ago with Gary Becker, a professor of economics at Chicago and also a Nobel Prize winner. They indeed shared a blog, Becker Posner blog, until Gary Becker died a few years ago. And Mr. Posner continued. Now, this is interesting. Judge Posner said, let's look into it. And I want to take my hat off to this conservative judge because he did the research and he had the courage to publish it. And he did so. And it's available if you go on the website, look up Richard Posner, you'll find your way to this blog of his with Gary Becker and to the research he did on public employees. Let me simply report to you this research, which was done back in 2011. I believe from my notes it was 2011. It's possible it was 2009, but the results of that research cover a long period of time and are just as valid today as they were then. Here's what the judge found. Bluntly and simply, there is no relationship between the percentage of your people that work for the public sector and how well you're doing, how fast you're growing, how high your standard of living is. Let me repeat that. None. That the conservative idea that there's something negative about public employees and that the economy doesn't do well when you have a lot of them is simply stone-cold false. Here's what Mr. Posner, Judge Posner, found. Here are the five countries in the world with the highest percentage of public employees. Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland, and Hungary. Sweden and Norway, for example, and Denmark, are among the countries in which working people report the highest level of satisfaction of any countries in the world. Their standards of living are as high or higher than those in the United States. These are highly successful countries, highly sophisticated societies. And in those countries, the proportion of public employees relative to private is higher than in most other countries. Indeed, out of the first five, only Hungary is a relatively poorer country, and therefore four out of five refute it. By the way, all of those countries have a higher percentage of public employees than Greece does. And here's one final thought. One of the countries that has a higher percentage of public employees than Greece is Canada, which has been doing real well, thank you, over the last decades, and once again demonstrates that the notion that public employees are a negative economic reality is simply false. Well, folks, we've come to the end of the first half of this program. I want to urge you, please, to stay with us. We will be back in a very short number of seconds when we can rejoin and focus on the more substantial, detailed analyses of the sort we concentrated on over the last 3 weeks. Before leaving, I do want to remind you, please, take a look at our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update for this July season of the year. In this second half, as we often do, I want to begin by reminding you of the websites that we maintain that really are an adjunct to, an auxiliary to, if you like, this program, that provide all kinds of supplemental materials that I believe you will find interesting and engaging. We survey the news each day and post on our website stories that we think will interest you. We carry interviews that I do on major media, lectures that I give, monthly statements I make about the economy at the world-famous Judson Memorial Church in Washington Square, New York City, and so on. I want to also tell you that those websites are ways for you to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Simply click on the icons and you will be able to get in touch with us on a much more regular basis. Our websites also allow you to sign up for our absolutely free newsletter, which is yet another way to keep abreast of the economic changes around us and the analysis we offer of them. And finally, our websites are a way for you to communicate with me and with the team that produces this program. That's right. There are email simple ways for you to tell us what you like and don't like, to raise questions that I will select for answering on the air. Please make use of these websites in all these ways and validate in that way all the work we do to produce, maintain, and update them. First website is rdwolf.com, rdwolf.com, and the other one is democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. Okay, let's turn to two major topics closely related today that you have asked about, that have come to me in huge numbers as something that I should address. The one that's going to take most of the rest of this program is Greece, because so much has happened there. We have been reporting on it now for years, and big changes have occurred, and they need a comment, and I will devote most of the second half of this program to precisely that. But before I do, a different topic, even though it's closely related. This has to do with foreign debts of companies, foreign debts of countries. The two countries in the news with huge such debts, and so people have been focused on them, have been Greece, of course, but also the country of Argentina in Latin America. Argentina is in an ongoing struggle with a number of hedge funds in New York City, now called around the world vulture funds, thanks to the antipathy, the opposition of the leadership in Argentina, which is determined not to pay a significant portion of its debts as a nation. Much as Greece tried, so far unsuccessfully, to avoid paying huge debts that were run up by earlier Greek governments. So I want to talk about this question of the national debts of many countries, using Greece and particularly Argentina as an example. So let's begin with Argentina. Part of the debts of Argentina have to do with a coup d'etat, a decision by the military authorities, a portion of them, in Argentina, back in 1976, to overthrow the elected legitimate Argentinian government, led by a general Jorge Videla, who took over the government of Argentina in 1976 and ruled it for a bunch of years after that. There was massive opposition inside Argentina to this illegal military coup. And it was very difficult for that military coup to stay in power. So what the military coup did was appeal, in this case, to the United States government to support it, and to banks, particularly in New York and elsewhere in the United States, huge banks, to lend this illegal government large amounts of money, which the government needed because otherwise, as most observers believed then and now, it would have failed to stay in power much sooner than it did. It got the support of the United States, at least enough to get the banks in New York and elsewhere to lend billions of dollars. Okay, now let's look at this from the standpoint first of the Argentinian people. They didn't want a coup d'etat. They didn't want the illegal government to stay in power. They neither supported, approved, nor in many cases knew that that government, to stay in power, was using money borrowed from banks in the United States. After a bunch of years, they overthrew their illegal coup d'etat government and reinstalled elected governments. Question: should the people of Argentina, who suffered the coup d'etat, who suffered the dictatorial government of General Videla, be now required to pay back the loans given to that illegal government to oppress them? In other words, you're asking the Argentinian people, the people who lived then and their descendants, to pay the cost of a coup and a dictatorship they did not want. Are we surprised that the Argentinian people say, through their leader, Mrs. Kirchner, no, we won't? I think we would be surprised with any other outcome. They don't want to pay. They don't think they have to. And I want to make it really clear as an economist that I could not agree more with their opposition. Let me explain how and why. When banks make a decision to lend money to a government, they are supposed to do, quote unquote, due diligence. They are supposed to see whether the borrowing entity is a reliable, secure borrower, and to say, if it isn't the case that we can assure your capacity to repay, then we shouldn't make the loan. Now, of course, every lender understands there's risks, and they're supposed to assess the risks. The lenders in 1976 knew perfectly well, like everybody else, that General Videla was operating a coup d'etat, that huge numbers of people in Argentina didn't want his government, didn't want the coup d'etat, and certainly didn't support borrowing from foreign countries to stay in power. But those banks made the decision to lend the money anyway. Okay, let's leave that in their hands. You made the decision. Well now, bankers, you have to take the risk that if you lend to an unpopular dictator, or for that matter, to any dictator, and the people finally get rid of that dictator, you will not get paid the money you lent that enabled that dictator to stay in power. And you have to take the loss. And if you don't want to have the risk of that happening, well, then don't lend to dictators. Don't lend to governments that are hated by their people, where that hatred is clear and obvious, and where the people clearly do not, in huge majorities, support what's going on. You can't have it both ways. You can't lend the money claiming you're taking a prudent risk, and then when it turns out you bet on the wrong horse, claim that the people who you helped to suppress by your loans need to pay you back for doing so. It is outrageous. And it also has a terrible effect. It means that banks, by this system, are in fact encouraged, if this works, if they get paid off, encouraged to lend to whatever criminal, crooked government arises. And remember, when a coup d'etat like that of General Videla in Argentina happens, these governments are always shaky in power. They have usurped the democratic rights of the people in that society. They are very shaky. And guess what they do? They're desperate for money to stay in power, to consolidate their power, to build up their strength, to buy up oppositions. They're desperate for money, and they turn to foreign banks. And the foreign banks like this game because they know this coup d'etat government will pay any interest rate they charge. Because for the borrower, the borrowers are desperate. These generals, these coup d'etats, they're worried about staying in power. They know the bill will only come years later. They can pay high interest because what they need is a lot of money right now. And so the deal is wonderful for the banks. They can lend huge amounts. They can charge whatever virtually they want. They've got this new dictator in a position where he has to come across. So they've made tons of money. Now they want to be paid off by the victims of the general they kept in power, and they wonder why Argentinians are opposed. But this, of course, is how capitalism works. Just as we saw at the beginning of the program, how it works with the war between Coca-Cola and Pepsi. Then we saw how it works with the pharmaceuticals jacking up the prices of cancer drugs. Now we see how it works with foreign debt. The story in Greece is similar. Greek politicians, who have since been denounced and rejected by the mass of the Greek people in successive votes since 2012, culminating in the referendum early in July. The mass of the Greek people repudiate what previous governments did, which included making loans they shouldn't have taken from banks who should have known better. Those banks took a chance, and they didn't want to face the risk. So they got the rest of Europe, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, institutions funded by taxpayers' money, to come in and lend money to Greece so it could pay off the private bankers. So the private bankers didn't take the losses they could have and should have taken when their risky investment in governments that no longer represented their people didn't pan out. Very similar to Argentina. But they won't have it. And so the Greek government that came into power in January, the Syriza government, January of this year, spent 5 months, 6 months, negotiating with the Europeans around the central question, we don't want to pay all these debts. We want freedom from debts that shouldn't have been made, that were made by irresponsible politicians, manipulating public opinion, manipulating the media. And when those debts were made, when those loans were made, the banks should have paid the price of having lent money to a country that couldn't afford it, that was getting in way over its head, all of which they knew. Just a footnote here for those of you that are interested in these questions. There's some story that the Greeks hid in their statistics part of their loans. That seems to be the case. And who helped them hide their loans? A banking firm well known to you, Goldman Sachs from New York, which manipulated the statistics and the loans in order to allow the Greek government to borrow more than it was showing to the public. And if the banks in Europe want to get angry at somebody for having lent money to Greece without knowing the full extent of Greeks' debts, then the people they should be angry at are Goldman Sachs, which helped Greece hide the reality. Go recover from Goldman Sachs. That would be a great lesson for Goldman Sachs not to do that again. They got a big fat fee from the Greek government for helping them. But the bottom line is, if you lend to a country that already has enormous debts, which they knew, and that is a struggling poor economy, which Greece has long been, and that therefore may not be able to repay, then take your losses. And if you don't want those losses in Greece and elsewhere, don't make the loans. This is a basic question of decency, and it has been understood across the world. Lenders are forever making loans to people who, for reasons that are often everybody tried hard, but circumstance didn't allow it, the borrower can't pay back. And when that happens, you go to court, and you have a settlement. And in that settlement, the borrower has to pay a penalty because he, she can't pay back. And the lender has to pay a penalty because they obviously lent to somebody misunderstanding their risk. So both sides made errors and both sides share in make. The Europeans didn't want to do that. They don't want to let the Greeks off the hook, not at all in many cases, or very little and not enough. You can't get Greece out of the hole unless you forgive large amounts of its debts. If you want to solve the problem without making Greece an impoverished, desperate country for decades to come, then you have to forgive the debts. That's the way it works when you lend in an inappropriate and irresponsible way. But the Europeans refuse. They seem to want to crush this little poor corner. Not a good sign about European unity. Not a good sign about the project of unifying a country, including its rich and its poorer areas. Not a sign of what German leadership of a unified Europe looks like and the directions it's going. And so I cannot forbear one more time to remind everybody of 1953, when a German economy in terrible poor shape because the country had lost World War II, had gotten savagely bombed, had wasted its economic potential on military adventures it lost. And it was deeply in debt to boot. So Germany in 1953 turned to the creditors, U.S., Britain, France, and said, we can't rebuild a strong Germany that will be able to function in the world unless you forgive our debts. We won't be a good ally of yours against the Soviet Union in the Cold War unless you forgive our debts. And they met in London from February to autumn of 1953. And finally, they reached an agreement and they signed the documents. It's called the London Agreement of 1953. And here's what it did, friends. It erased half, 50%, of the total German debt. That's it. Debt forgiven. And it took the other half, which was due in a few years, and stretched it out over a 30-year period so that the annual payments Germany had to make to Britain, France, and the United States were reduced to next to nothing. The Germans begged for, demanded, and got what in the last 5 months, indeed the last 2 or 3 years, they could not and would not even consider for Greece. It's remarkable. And what it does is condemn Greece if they don't relent. It condemns Greece to a level of poverty and inequality with people in Holland or Germany or France or other parts of so-called unified Europe that is the greatest possible danger to that unity. And remember, European unity was supposed to help Europe avoid another world war. Europe tore itself apart in World War I and World War II. Twice in the 20th century, masses, millions of people killed, economies set back, lives destroyed. They were supposed to get unified in order to avoid the kinds of awful, vicious, inappropriate behavior that the Germans have led, and many other Europeans have been part of this, European leaders, against a new government in Greece, a poor country that wants to go in a different direction. 61%, a democratic majority of Greeks, said they wanted to go in a different direction. German government, leading the Dutch, Finnish, French and other governments won't permit the democratic preferences of the people in Greece to have any role to play whatsoever. And so the Europeans, to force the Greeks to their knees, took away their currency. That's right. Starting several months ago, they began to restrict the amount of money that the Greek banks and businesses had available to themselves to run their economy, to make sure the milk is available for the children, that the subways run, that the buses move people around, that the factories are working, etc. Eventually, a few weeks ago, they said a new control. You can't get more than 60 euros out of your bank account, with or without a cash machine, per day. By the way, still in effect as I speak. And eventually, they went to the Greeks and they said, we're going to cut off all the money. You're going to have nothing. And your economy is going to collapse. There won't be medicines for sick people. There won't be food. There won't be transportation. And the people in their misery and suffering will throw you out as a politician. So either you collapse and do what we tell you, or we'll simply, literally, starve you out. And so the Greek government, which was fighting hard for 5 months, capitulated. Alex Tsipras, the leader, announced that the Greeks would accept what the Europeans imposed on them, accept that they have to pay the debts, accept that they have to squeeze their people to raise the money to pay the debts, cut public employment, cut public pensions, set aside the assets of the government of Greece, the water system, property on the seashore, and sell it off to whoever has the money to buy it, and to use that money to pay their debts. No questions asked. Wow. And the Greeks said, okay, if we're going to starve us, we'll change our politics. Even though the majority of people voted against it, we'll do what the majority voted against, because we're forced to by the Europeans, who literally will starve us out by taking away the money we need to have. Can we criticize the Tsipras government? Should they have prepared their own currency to substitute? Probably. But Monday morning quarterbacking is always easy. They believed that they could work a deal with Europe, that Europe wouldn't be so harsh. They were wrong, but it's a mistake they made. And now they pay. But they also live to fight another day. And the fight now shifts from the debts, which they can't do very much about. They'll get a little help, but nothing like what they need. Now the fight shifts to domestic, to life inside Greece. And there the question will be what it has always been. Will the Greek economy continue to be poor and weak? Or will it go after the enormous wealth of a tiny number of Greeks who sit on top of a very unequal society in order to make that wealth serve the needs of the mass of people? That's the next challenge for the Tsipras government. And before we pass judgment on them, given the pressures Europe put on them, let's see how they do in the domestic struggles they're going to now undertake. In the little time that remains to me, I want to answer a question that I hope occurred to you as we went through what I just discussed about debts and more generally about Greece. Why, you might be wondering, why the viciousness of the German, Dutch, and indeed most of the rest of European governments' attack on a poor, small Greece? What is this about? Greek people work longer hours than German people do. Greek people have a lower standard of living than most of Middle and Northern Europe. The stories about Greece having large numbers of people on pension is misleading. Their ages are higher, and many people who lost their jobs in the crisis since 2008 were better off taking their pensions early because they got a little bit better that way, not that it's much, compared to what they would have gotten on limited unemployment. And the Greeks, a little 2% of the European economy, they're not responsible for the crisis since 2008. They're one of its major victims. The exposure of what's the reality requires you to ask the question, where does the viciousness come from? Particularly from Merkel in Germany, Schäuble, her finance minister, and so on. I think the answer is actually from the United States that we can look for the answer. Let me explain. In the middle of the last presidential campaign, I believe it was May 2012, the Republican candidate, Mitt Romney, was caught by a secret camera, apparently, giving a talk to some of his wealthy donors. And in that talk, he famously said something like the following. 47%, I remember that number, 47% of the American people live off the hard work of the other 53%. Those 43% are people who work for the public sector, who get food stamps, who get welfare, who get one or another entitlement from the government. And they don't work. They're lazy. They'll never vote for Republicans, Mr. Romney said, because they vote for Democrats just to keep the gravy train going for those entitlements they live off. And I want to be the president for the other, the 53% of Americans who work hard and pay the taxes that are then wasted on those lazy others. Mr. Romney got a lot of flack for saying that, as well he should have. It was an unbelievable insult to half the population. It was not factually true. Many, many pointed out afterwards that the majority of people getting help from the government work very hard in relatively low-paying jobs, etc. But that's not what I want to stress to you. This is vicious. What this does is make half the people think that their economic problem comes from the poor folks, the ones on government help, not from the companies that decided to move out of the country, not from the companies that are squeezing their workers on making them pay, live on very low wages. No, no, no. Your problem is poor people. And that's what Mrs. Merkel did. That's what the Europeans just did. They said to the workers in Germany and France and Holland and Finland, your problem isn't a capitalism that doesn't treat you well. Your problem is taking care of poor people who live high on the hog and do no work in places like Greece or Spain or Portugal or Italy. Ugly, ugly, untrue, vicious. That helps explain what is going on in Europe and why it is so dangerous for any reasonable project, not only of European Union, but of a decent society. Capitalism is shifting from the West to the East. It's leaving behind destroyed communities, impoverished people. If they fight with one another the way Romney and Merkel champion, then we will all lose. Thank you very much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Let me ask you again, take a look at our websites for more of this kind of an analysis, rdwolf.com, democracyatwork.info. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Go to the websites to do that. Let us know what you think about the program. It really helps us in designing this show. And I look forward to speaking with you again next week.